You're the Country Breakfast on RN. Let's hit the road with our rural reporters. This week, we're trapping foxes and feral cats at Uluru. We get a lesson in stock handling techniques, Northern Territory style, and join exhibitors at the 89th annual Bega Valley Poultry Show. And if you like dogs, then you're going to love the Casterton Kelpie Muster Auction, where top dogs can earn top prices.
I bid 5,000 better. I bid 5,000 better. I bid 5,000.
The hardest part of the whole thing, of course, is parting with them. But I just see it, well, I parted with my children because I educated them and they had to leave home and go and get a job. Well, it's the same with our working dogs. We train them up, teach them right from wrong, and today they graduate and they go and get themselves a real job and they get themselves a real ute and a real mob of sheep and, yeah, their own farm.
This year, $1.74 million changed hands. That story coming up later. But we begin today in the shadow of Uluru, where a concerted effort is being made to control feral animals.
At the moment, we're in one of the most special parts of the park, in my opinion. People don't get to come here often, and it's a shame because in front of us is one of the most spectacular views of Kadajuri you get, and behind us is Uluru in the distance. And this area we call the bore field. It's a transitional spinifex sandplain, and it's a really special part of the park, not only because it's so beautiful, but also because our endangered species live here.
And National Park Ranger Kerry Bennison here in Central Australia is doing all she can to make sure these little native animals are kept safe from the introduced feral cats and foxes that roam this area. And the tools she plans to use? A chicken wire double trap and the recorded sound of a cat on heat. Apparently, it works a treat. Hello, my name's Lauren Fitzgerald, and I'm off to check out the trap with Kerry and find out more about the endangered animals which call this place home.
This is the habitat for three out of our five threatened species. One's called a brush-tailed mulgara. It's a marsupial, but it looks like a big mouse with this amazing black, fuzzy, spiky tail. It's probably about the size of a European rat. We don't have rats out here, but think that size. And this is a marsupial with a little pouch, big eyes, quite ferocious when you catch them. And then we have the great desert skink. It's a big pink lizard, like a blue tongue, but pink. Quite special because it lives in familial burrows, so it'll live with its wife and children, last year's children and this year's children, before the males move out to find their own burrow. And then the marsupial mole, that cryptic, enigmatic species that people who live here a long time are lucky enough to get to see, they live out here as well.
And why are they endangered?
Because they get predated on by cats and foxes. And as you can see, there was a wildfire through this area a couple of years ago. And what tends to happen is cats and foxes will be restricted to dune tops and roads because they don't like walking through the spiky spinifex. And then when we get a fire, we're starting to see that those animals are able to move out a lot more and access a lot more of the population. So this year we've seen a decline in, unfortunately, in both of those species because of that wildfire.
Now, we've just made a stop at a enclosure. It's about 2 metres high, maybe 4 metres long, and covered in chicken wire with two traps on either side. This is for those predators?
Yeah, these are our most successful control method to date. We've spent many years trying to perfect. We don't bait here at the park, and that's for a couple of reasons. We're still unsure of the dingo effect on foxes and cats. We do feel that they do keep them down to a certain degree, and so we don't want to bait our dingoes out. Dingoes here have never been baited, so they're quite stable family packs. So we are thinking that they're reducing our cat and fox population for us. The other reason is our traditional owners here. Dingoes are really important animals for them, so baiting's probably not the way we want to go. So we have to look at other options, and trapping is one option. And here is a trap that was developed by Jim Clayton, a man in my team, a couple of years ago. And as you said, it's got two traps at either end of a big cage. Now, both those traps are dual entry. So both of the ends flip up. So when a cat or fox looks through this trap, it sees the rabbit in the middle that we use as bait, but it sees a thoroughfare through that can pick up the rabbit and go through.
Now, Kerry, it's very nice of you to bring me out here to have a look at the trap, but there was a practical purpose for you to check on this trap today.
Yeah, there was. We use rabbits, as you can see in the middle, as our bait, and I wanted to come and see that the rabbit was still here and looking all right. And also we use a special, they're called FAPs, felid attracting phonics, and they make a call like a cat in heat, and I just wanted to make sure that the batteries were still functioning all right in that phonic.
Okay, so it is working?
It is working, yes.
It's oh so faint.
Because it's supposed to be just one single cat out here in heat, and if it was booming out through the place, it would sound very artificial. But it would be picked up by cats in the surrounding area, hopefully. And they've been tested in lots of parts of the arid zone, and they work. So it's just another bait method that we can try to lure them into our trap here.
How often do you find predators in here?
Well, they've been quite successful for us. The year before last, we were able to take up, I think it was about 62 cats out, but only 2 foxes. They're not so good for foxes at the moment. Last year we had less predators around. It was a dry year, so I think we got about 25 or so. And for us, it's not a huge amount. It doesn't sound like a huge amount, but for us that's a really large amount because it's working at least. It's half successful. It's taken a long time to find a method that actually does catch cats. They're very tricky. We don't use the soft jaw traps, which are probably a really good method because we're worried about what other species get trapped in them. So these can be quite specific. If we come and there's something in there that we don't particularly want trapped, we can let it go and it's fine.
Have you ever had that happen where something has made its way in that shouldn't have?
Yeah, very much so. The other day I was checking the traps and there was a minor bird in the trap, and I was able just to lift it up and let it go. It was sitting under the shade cloth area, nice and calm. So it's a really good way. It's a non-lethal way that we can control what we destroy and what we don't.
In a way, you were almost protecting it for a little while.
I was. That was at the back of the cultural centre, protecting it from lots of visitors.
Yeah. And in terms of the problem at the moment with predators, where do you think it's at? Is it under control or do you still have a long way to go?
No, it's not under control. We're further ahead than we were a few years ago. We've got the resort working in partnership with us, so they're doing trapping in the resort. The Mutijula community, we're starting to do some trapping around the community itself, and that's reducing the number of animals that actually end up here in the boar fields. But by no means is it under control. It's an ongoing war.
I don't think there's any difference between cattle, people, horses, dogs. I think you work them all the same. Some you feed a bit more than others.
Some use motorbikes, others prefer choppers and horses. And then there's the vexed issue of cattle dogs. Some producers swear by them, others steer well clear. Hello, I'm Carmen Brown. It appears that cattlemen and women in Northern Australia all have their own way of handling stock. I've caught up with a few of them at work in their yards across the Kimberley region and in the Northern Territory. While they might employ a range of different mustering techniques on their properties, there's one thing they can all agree on. Quiet cattle are the best cattle.
Tom Shepherd. I work for Consolidated Pastoral Company. I manage Newry Station. You know, once you learn to read cattle and that, they'll tell you what they want done with them. And if you think of things a basic way, you know, cattle always move. So you just got to get them to move in the direction you want them to go. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, no noise or big pressure, or you can pressure cattle. It's just you got to know when to release it.
Do you think there's a really big difference between properties as to people's style?
Yeah, it's, wherever you go, it doesn't matter whoever you're working for. It's even on this place here. If you're working for me or my head stockman, there's a big difference in styles there. You know, I think we all got our own beliefs, and which way's right and which way's wrong, well, depends on who you're talking to.
Do you think there should be a more consistent approach right across the industry?
I think it's probably a bit hard to... I think there should be, yeah, but I think it's a bit hard because it's different climates, different country, different people, different management setups. Yeah, it's sort of... you got to change your ideas no matter where you are. You know, if you're all fenced in paddocks and that and laneways and everything's... you know, you're doing one way, and then if you've got all bush country, well, you've got to, you know, do a different approach, you know. Nothing's the same. You've got to be adaptable.
Hello, my name's Mike Shaw, Spring Creek Station in the Kimberley, just below the Lake Argyle. You've been here for about 12 years. Well, one of the skills I have got is I can fly a helicopter, so I've got my own helicopter, so I do all my own mustering. I still muster a pretty well old-fashioned style, except for that we've got a helicopter, and we block the cattle up away from the yard somewhere, wherever the cattle want to run to. I muster to where they want to run and block them up where they want to run to. Usually it's downhill, always downstream, downhill. Block them up, and someone's usually leading my horse along. We block them up, land my chopper, off on my horse, and we walk them home.
So it comes down to the personality of the livestock handler, really, doesn't it?
Personality and what your skills are and economics, yeah. If you reckon, some people reckon, if you can run those cattle straight into the yard with a helicopter and do it quietly, I'm not saying it's rip, tear and bust, I'm just poking along quietly, up laneways. If you can do it and not miss mother calves, well, good on you.
Ray Allard from Muckety Station. Well, I'd love to do it to my horse if I could, but these days, mate, you're flat out getting anybody who can ride a horse. And you can't get anybody to ride young horses. And nobody wants to ride horses. They all want to ride motorbike, bikes or bull catchers. See, and the way I muster now is motorbikes, bull catchers and an aeroplane.
You would prefer horses. Why is that?
Well, it makes the cattle quieter and they're better handled. You know, but at the moment, we can't get anybody to ride horses, so I tail a lot on motorbikes. You know, I tail all my wieners on motorbikes a lot, and if the cattle are a bit touchy, I tail them too, yeah.
Have you had many problems with cattle coming from other properties that are not used to that style of handling?
Oh, yeah. Some you know, like I get cattle on a gistment here, and some of them come down at a bit rank, you know. They haven't seen too much handling in paddocks, you know. Half of them get no respect for fences, they just go straight through them.
And I imagine it takes a fair bit of your time to work with them to quieten them down too.
Yeah, it takes a fair while, but it pays off in the end, you know. They get quiet and you can do anything with them then, you know. Like if everybody put more time in the tail and all that, the cattle would be a lot better quiet. And the sale yards don't like them like that. They like them quiet when they come down, not galloping around, bouncing off rails and that, you know. And the quieter you can get them, the better it is, huh?
I'm Lee Ford and I'm from Tennant Creek Station. We have a lot of dogs and we try to do a lot with horses, tail our wieners and sort of, yeah, and we always sort of, the dogs are very good. Anything that's sort of a bit rough or that, we sort of put the dogs onto them and bring it back in. So it sort of saves a lot. We never lose too many with them, but, and it just educates, yeah, and the herd sort of just seems a lot better now. Like we just spend time in handling them with, like, yeah, just walking them a lot with horses and holding them and feeding and, yeah, and the dogs are all quite handy.
I guess the other thing with handling livestock is the safety aspect. What can go wrong, in your experience, if cattle are a little bit wild?
Yeah, if they're a little bit wild, but all the young fellas, they like it. But anyhow, I worry. And, yeah, if, I don't know, I suppose they can always sort of get a bit hurt when they step off to them and that sort of thing, but yeah, hopefully they're handy enough that nothing goes wrong too much. They're pretty good here because, yeah, they're not allowed to stir them up. Ken gets a bit stirred up if they stir them up.
Lee Ford from Tennant Creek Station on the Barkly Tableland, ending that report from Carmen Brown on the best way to handle stock in Northern Australia. Still to come on Rural Reporter, the Casterton Kelpie Muster, and we go inside the poultry pavilion at Bega.
Poultry breeding, that's what I've said in many times, you've always got an egg about the place and you can always eat your mistake. That's the way it happens.
Yes. A ready supply of eggs and being able to eat your mistakes. Some of the benefits of being a poultry owner. Hello, I'm Michael Kavner. And as you can probably hear, I'm surrounded by more than 800 chickens, ducks and geese. All entered in the 89th annual Bega Poultry Show on the far south coast of New South Wales. There's bantams, leghorns, Old English game, Plymouth Rocks and Rhode Island Reds, Indian runners, even some young Austral Orps, like these ones in front of me, which are facing up to the judges for the first time.
An Australian bird, they're a challenging bird, and you get a good one, they go a long way. This is their first show, and I'm sort of blooding them for the Australian Austral Orp Championships of Dubbo at the end of June. This is just an outing for them. They're just getting used to people and being handled and that sort of thing. I'll take them home and nurture them now for a month.
You say you're going to nurture them. What do you actually do? What, do you have them in the house and
no.
Walk them around?
You don't know my wife. No, we've got special pens for them, coops at home and on good clean store, and we've got them on a high-protein diet. It's a bit of work, but it's a lot of fun.
Peter O'Brien was a dairy farmer in the Bega Valley for 40 years before retiring. But all through his life, his hobby was chooks. His father is credited with having the Austral Orp recognised as a separate breed from its English ancestor. Restrictions on importing rare birds has led to greater interest in shows like this one, as breeders look for good bloodlines.
A lot of trading goes on at the shows. In my dad's days, you would send fowls out, and Dad used to send them all over Australia. You can't do that anymore. Like, there used to be a railhead at Cooma, he'd take a trailer load of fowls and pull the back seat out of the old car and fill her up full of boxes of chooks and send them all over. Buses won't take them. It doesn't happen anymore. And you ask a truckie, will you take a live chook somewhere, and they're a bit reluctant to do it.
You've got about 200 birds. When you breed them up, you take them to shows, they do well, they get your ribbons and trophies. When you get home and they've reached that age, do you put them out to pasture?
These are young cockles and pullets we're looking at in here now. The male birds, you get a couple of years of breeding out of them as a cock bird. You can't have a geriatric farm for old birds, so, you know, they go by the wayside, you know, like we dispose of them.
When you say dispose of them, you mean to say that one day you could be sitting down at the dining room table with some friends around for lunch, and the bloke that we're looking at that's come in third could be gracing the big white plate?
Oh, well, I don't think it'll happen to him, because by the time I get a couple of years breeding out of him, you'd have to cook him with a stone, and when the stone's cooked, you chuck the chook away and eat the stone. They get pretty tough.
Many of the breeds won't end up on the dinner plate or give a regular supply of eggs. Some are there for their plumage. In Derek Lewis's case, the sheep and cattle farmer has done well with his old English game birds. With their distinctive green and rust-coloured feathers, they're often depicted hanging in the kitchen in old paintings. They were once bred for their fighting abilities, an instinct that they've not lost.
We just keep them as replicas of what they once were, and to me they're just something very special.
Have they still got that fighting instinct in them after all those years?
It's the hardest thing about rearing them. If you get males who have established a territory, they will just fight till they drop, and females as well. We've had some crazy old hens, and they'll fight till they're lying on their back, and you've got to have separate cages for all your mature males. You run the younger males with a older, strong male who tends to sort of keep them all in order.
There seems to be a trend for people to come back looking for purebred poultry. They want half a dozen Austral Orp pullets to put in the backyard, or some white Leghorns or some brown Leghorns, and I have trouble helping people out with them, so it's good to see it. They're hard to come by.
Is there any particular breeds that you recommend for that sort of lifestyle?
Austral Orps are great fowl, don't get me wrong. They're a good table fowl, a good laying fowl, but they're a bit prone to broodiness. Then they get in the backyard, lay up a few eggs, and they want to go clucky, but some of the breeds they've got now, like the light breeds, the Leghorns and the Andalusians, or some of those different lighter breeds, they're not prone to broodiness. When you go and look for a chook, see the lobe on that fowl there? He's got a red earlobe. Well, you go over the, up along the road to the Leghorns, and they've got a white earlobe. Anything with a white earlobe will lay a white-shelled egg, and they're not prone to broodiness. But the one with the red earlobe will always go brooding.
Whether it's running miles in the paddocks, getting trampled in the yards, or simply sitting quietly by its owner's feet of a night, it's the Kelpie's loyalty that really sets it apart as a true farmer's friend. But how much is a good dog actually worth?
Black and tan, at 1 year and 10 months of age, he is a genuine all-round worker. He backs, he barks, he's got good force in the yards, he's easy to control in the paddock. Terrific nature and personality.
Well, it's a question that's being answered here at the annual Kelpie Muster.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you'll agree. Lot number 33.
Hello, I'm Danielle Grindley at Casterton, a small town in Victoria's southwest. For the past 18 years, dog breeders and buyers have been making the pilgrimage here. And from humble beginnings, the muster has grown, with almost 4,000 people attending this year. They have dog breeder Ian McDonnell and an old black Kelpie to thank for the event.
I remember going to a clearing sale not far from Casterton, would have been back in the early 90s, and this farmer sold all his plant and tractors, etc., and then they come time to sell the stock, and they had this old black Kelpie that just pushed them. You know, they'd sell one mob of sheep, and then they had this black Kelpie there that'd go and get the next mob and bring them up, and they'd sell that mob. And at the end, when it was all over, they actually auctioned the dog, poor old black dog that had been working there all day, and he sold really well. And I thought, well, what's happened here is everybody at the sale here has seen this dog demonstrate, and then they've had the opportunity to purchase him. And I just thought, well, wow, there's an opportunity there.
Did you picture it was going to be like this 18 years on?
I remember saying early on that I would like it to grow, you know, to become to the working dog fraternity what the yearling sales are in Sydney to the racehorse fraternity, and people laughed at me and they thought, well, you know, that's not possible, because auctioning dogs then was a total new concept, hadn't been done before.
Why do you think it has been so successful?
Well, I think it's the working dog. It's just got that pull to people's heartstrings. It's part of the country's culture and heritage, and I think people just, you know, it's a bit like the Dreiserbones and the Anzacs and Vegemite and the Kelpies are all there, you know. People just want to be part of it.
Can you take us back to that first auction? How many dogs did you have, and what were the prices like?
Yeah, I think we had 28 dogs, and we begged for people to actually bring them forward to sell them, because auctioning dogs was unheard of. The standard of dog wasn't very high. I think the top price was $2,000.
There were no auctions back in the day, but what were people selling their dogs for? Were there high prices like we see now?
No, absolutely not. People sort of had the idea that you could go out and buy a fully trained dog for $200 or $300 or $400. That was it. And I think because they are now worth a lot more, the market has set the price. People look after them a lot better, treat them a lot better, and they go out of their way to find better ways of training them. And I think that's been the greatest part, is to put a value on the dog so that people actually look after them so much better. And if you look after them, they'll repay you 10 times over.
Right, number 54, bought yourself a very, very, very good dog.
At the end of the auction, 957 dogs and nearly $1.75 million had changed hands. For the seventh time, Ian McDonnell had the top-selling dog. 20-month-old Coke was bought by the Williams family from Lillima in Victoria for $10,000.
$10,000, here we go, second. You'll kick yourself all the way home. Oh, then $10,000, third and final, will we? Quick, dark, $10,000.
The hardest part of the whole thing, of course, is parting with them. But I just see it, well, I parted with my children because I educated them and they had to leave home and go and get a job. Well, it's the same with our working dogs. We train them up, teach them right from wrong. And today they graduate and they go and get themselves a real job, and they get themselves a real ute and a real mob of sheep and, yeah, their own farm.
The best thing with puppies is crate training, and what you need to do...
Also here selling his dogs is breeder and trainer Paul McPhail. He's been making the 14-hour round trip from Gippsland since 2000. This year he bid three dogs farewell at the auction and made a few other sales on the side.
It's the best place to show off my dogs. There's a good audience, there's a lot of people want dogs, and I can go out there with a good dog and show them and get pretty good money for them.
Do you have your own Kelpie that you just never sell?
Gloria. She's just super easy. She's super smart, she knows the stuff, we don't argue much. Yeah, we just click. Her mother, Sophie, I was taking to the auctions, but I fell in love with her and I couldn't sell her.
While the auction might be the most important part of the Kelpie muster, it's certainly not the crowd favourite.
Get up!
Committee man Don Matthews is in charge of running the Kelpie high jump, where dogs scramble up and over a wooden hurdle at their master's command.
2.42 metres.
He's got a record number on the starting block this year.
Oh yeah, the world's premier dog jumping event is. There is nothing like it. Our record's 2.91 metres. A lot of people spend a lot of time on their dogs to get them here.
Well, we've got one, and that's knocked a few nerves about.
In the end, the field was whittled down to three, and then just one, with reigning champion Mo leaping 2.49 metres. His owner, Jared Quick, doesn't take any credit for Mo's prowess at the high jump.
Mo's 4.5 years, and he hasn't had any training. He's just a bit of a natural, so...
A lot of people will be quite annoyed with that.
He hasn't jumped since we were here last year. He jumped 2.63 in 2012 and got second.
So what is it that makes him jump, do you think?
Just his loyalty, I think. Yeah, just loyal to me and just wants to be up there. So.
Right up, get up.
Jared Quick, the owner of the high jumping champion Moe, once again the winner at the Casterton Kelpie Muster. Thanks to Danielle Grindley for that report. And you can see Moe and some of his Kelpie mates in action if you log on to the website, check out the photographs and online feature at abc.net.au/rural.